paper, refusing to run any of them.
Maintenant, les sondages, ce sont des boîtes privées.
I don't believe the polls, which are all conducted by private companies who deliver the results, which they are paid to deliver. Macron's track record is catastrophic. He's achieved nothing for the average person. It's truly the dictatorship of a total capitalist. France has really reached the bottom.
The campaign hasn't been centered around the incumbent's record, but openly Islamophobic ideas. Despite running third or fourth in the polls, far-right convicted racist Eric Zemmour has been allowed by media executives to set the agenda.
The rise of the extreme right is totally unsupportable. And we have no choice but to confront these ideas of fascism, racism and xenophobia. France must stand up as one and say no. I'm sure that France will, and I'm sure no far-right candidate will reach the second round.
The resulting lack of serious issues appears certain to produce record abstention. Just 52% of France is interested in the vote this year, compared to 78% for the previous election.
3 weeks ago, all of the leading candidates were openly pro-Russian, but France's media has been swept by a wave of war hysteria, which usually benefits the incumbent. However, for many, at least that has pushed Islamophobia off the agenda, at least for now. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Saturday, over 30,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital against the escalating war between Russia and Ukraine. The initiative was called by trade unions, leftist groups and pro-peace movements as fighting rages on in a number of Ukrainian cities and talks between Kyiv and Moscow have produced very little so far. The protesters chanted slogans for peace and the end of all wars, urging the United Nations to do more to mediate between Russia, Ukraine and all parties related to the ongoing Ukrainian crisis.
Rather than investing in social welfare, labor, health and education systems, in Western countries have been wasting resources on armaments. Today, Russia must be held accountable for the Ukraine crisis.
Anti-war rallies have been held across Italy over the past days. Most of the demonstrations held in Rome, Palermo, Milan and other Italian cities have been in solidarity with Ukraine.
People at the rally have mixed feelings over who should be held accountable for the war in Ukraine. The majority believe there is a shared responsibility upon all the parts involved, from the US and the NATO, to Russia's president, Vladimir Putin.
In Italy, the most recent government update places the number of Ukrainian refugees who have entered the country since the start of the war at about 9,000. According to Ukrainian-Italian associations, up to 800,000-900,000 refugees may reach Italy in the coming weeks. Max Civili, Rome.
Head of the UN atomic watchdog, Rafael Grossi, was once again in Tehran in less than 3 months to resolve what he called important obstacles in the way of concluding the Vienna talks, which are ongoing between Iran and the P4+1, with the aim of reviving the 2015 deal. In a joint presser, Grossi and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, said they agree on a roadmap to resolve all the IAEA questions about Iran's nuclear program by late June.
It's a real pleasure to be back in Iran, in Tehran, and with President Islami, with whom we had a very fruitful and intense exchange this morning.
We have agreed to provide the IAEA by June 21st with documents related to outstanding questions between Tehran and the agency.
The IAEA has been seeking answers from Iran on traces of uranium it has allegedly found in old Iranian nuclear facilities. Falling in the category of the safeguards issues, this topic seems to be a major sticking point, blocking an agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks. And as Grossi described, it's intertwined with the fate of the discussions in Vienna.
They are very closely interrelated, and it would be difficult to believe or to imagine that such an important return to such a comprehensive agreement like Barjam would be possible if the agency and Iran would not be seeing eye to eye on how to resolve these important safeguards issues.
Iran has vehemently dismissed the IAEA's safeguards narrative as a political claim, calling on the nuclear watchdog to stick to its technical task and avoid being influenced by, quote, political lobbying.
I urge Mr. Grossi that political influence and lobbying should not impact the decisions of the IAEA. Iran and the IAEA should follow their issues in a completely professional way and behave within the framework of expertise.
Grossi's visit to Tehran is seen as a major push to sort out the last differences in the Austrian capital, which has hosted numerous rounds of talks to remedy the crippled 2015 deal. In 2018, then-U.S. President Donald Trump pulled Washington out of the accord and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran, in return, scaled back its compliance with part of the agreement.
Both Grossi and the Iranian atomic chief agreed that their meeting was fruitful. This could mean that another roadblock has been removed, and negotiators in Vienna will only have to cross the T's before a final conclusion is reached. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held yet another emergency meeting on Friday evening in Brussels to take stock of many Ukraine-related issues. The flow of refugees into EU nations was discussed at length. The impact of recently announced Western sanctions on Russia was assessed.
We are not under regime change. The sanctions are not in order to provoke a regime change in Russia.
Borrell says the sanctions are in fact designed to end the deadly conflict. NATO foreign ministers also met on Friday and reaffirmed their stance of not being drawn into the war. They acknowledged the results could be catastrophic. However, NATO allies continue to send thousands of additional troops into eastern parts of the 30-nation alliance.
And we have over 130 jets at high alert and over 200 ships from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Experts say the US is controlling all of the West's next moves, and the decision to supply deadly arms to Ukraine was a mistake.
The Europeans are saying to the Ukrainian, we're not going to send men to fight with you, we're not going to fight by your side, we give you weapons for you to fight. And had that not happened, President Zelensky would have talked to Russia from day one and avoided this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken attended all of the key events in Brussels on Friday, focusing on Ukraine.
Unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, this may not be over soon. And so these efforts that we're making together, we have to sustain them.
A number of political commentators are saying this crisis could have been averted if Russia's legitimate security concerns had been listened to. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Western media coverage of the conflict in Ukraine has come under the spotlight over what's seen as racist comments by journalists and their guests talking about the crisis affecting the Ukrainian people.
Me, I'm sorry, it's really emotional for me because I see European people with blue eyes and blonde hair being killed, children being killed every day with Putin's missiles and his helicopters and his rockets.
And so, of course, I understand and respect the emotion.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
We are not talking here about Syrians fleeing the bombing of the Syrian regime backed by Putin. We are talking about Europeans living in cars that look like ours to save their lives.
People across the world were quick to react to those comments.
I support Ukraine. I'm also upset at Western leaders for being hypocritical when it comes to taking action for Yemen and Palestine. A Ukrainian's life isn't worth any more or less than that of a Palestinian or Yemeni. We are all equal. We must condemn war everywhere. If you support Ukraine but not Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, if you condemn Russia but not Israel and the U.S., then congratulations, mate, you are on the highest tier of hypocrisy. Where were NATO, the USA, and their people when Israel was killing innocent Palestinian children? It's not Ukraine, it's Gaza, but no one stands for them.
Social media platforms have also been filled with comments criticizing different approaches by European countries in dealing with refugees. The Ukrainians fleeing the conflict in their country have received a warm welcome by their neighbors, including Poland. No problem with that. But these European states had a totally different stance back in 2015, when an influx of refugees escaping poverty and violence in Africa and the Middle East reached Europe. Some European authorities have even drawn a distinct line between the two groups of people.
These are not the refugees we are used to. Ukrainian people are Europeans. These people are intelligent. They are educated people. This is not the refugee wave we have been used to. People we were not sure about their identity. People with unclear pasts. Who could have been even terrorists?
Race and nationality again become important when people fleeing the Ukraine war are received. There have been reports of Africans being turned away at the border by security forces. Some of the journalists that were caught red-handed ended up apologizing for being, quote, insensitive. But questions remain that whether being a European means the mainstream media will be more likely to talk about their distress. Many may now hope that having darker skin or being from a certain religion doesn't make others ignore their pain and suffering.
It is unusually cold in Italy for early March. Forecasters have predicted freezing weather will hit the country from north to south over the next 10 days. Italians have been told not to worry about low temperatures for now. Their homes will be heated through the winter season. However, things could be very much different in the coming future. The government, led by Prime Minister Mario Draghi, has recently issued a decree in which, besides introducing a state of emergency over the conflict in Ukraine, it also referred to possible gas rationing following its decision to do without the Russian gas. Italy imports about 95% of its gas, 45% of which is coming from Russia.
Technically, Italy is already in a state of gas supply emergency. There is a plan in place at the Energy Ministry which features three levels of intervention. The country will resort to the maximization of its fossil fuel generated power in the first place. It will take years for Italy to replace Russian gas supplies. In the short term, only about one-third of the gas provided by Moscow can be sourced elsewhere.
In the wake of the Ukraine crisis, Rome is looking to boost gas supplies from other international partners. Italy is paying dearly for not having diversified more its energy sources and its suppliers throughout the years.
In an attempt to reduce Italy's dependence on Russian gas, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio has recently been to Algeria to discuss ways to increase gas supplies. Algeria is the second supplier of gas to Italy.
Italy held a self-destructive attitude when it came to diversifying its energy sources in the past. We used to have great gas suppliers such as Libya and Iran, but these countries were either thrown into a war or heavily sanctioned in the name of NATO's interests. And for this reason today, we depend very much on Russia's gas.
While the EU is expected to unveil a new energy strategy to reduce its member states' dependency from Moscow's gas, on Friday the Italian Foreign Minister Di Maio warned that if Russia thinks it can blackmail Italy on energy, then they've got their own country. According to some geopolitical experts, European countries must keep into account that Russia would be capable of turning off gas supplies to the old continent. Max Civili, Rome.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight, I'm Kavitat Wai. The Russian military operation against Ukraine is taking its toll, both on the Russian and also on the Ukrainian side. But there is another toll taking place, and that is the economic toll. There are no ambiguities about how the avalanche of sanctions against Russia is destroying the Russian economy. But what about the economy of European countries, or the U.S. for that matter? How about the rest of the world? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the economic warfare against Russia will make or break Russia first, or Europe, and the U.S. perhaps, a gamble with the economic brunt ultimately falling on the ordinary people.
Since Russia attacked Ukraine on February 24th, Western countries have resorted to a host of restrictive economic measures to hinder Russia's ability to finance its military offensive in Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe, in particular, have imposed what they call unprecedented sanctions on Russia. They have frozen the assets of Russia's central bank, limiting its ability to access $630 billion of reserves. Likewise, planned investments in Russia have been restricted as a result of imposing capital controls. Moreover, several Russian banks have been removed from the SWIFT payment system to further isolate the country from the global financial system.
The sanctions has been triggered by the war, and the purpose is to weaken the Russian economy.
The sanctions have led to a sharp devaluation of the Russian currency, the ruble, hence pushing up the inflation. The crushing ruble is creating growing panic among Russian citizens and increasing the inflation. Europe is under pressure to broaden sanctions by targeting Russia's energy sector, but the continent imports about 25% of its oil and 40% of its gas from Russia, and the huge energy reliance has turned out to be a stumbling block. Gas prices in Europe soared to record highs on Monday, on supply fears, reaching over $3,900 per 1,000 cubic meters for the first time in history. Sanctions on Russia are expected to further increase oil and gas prices, which will fuel inflation and intensify an already acute squeeze on living standards in Europe. Ending the war in Ukraine through pressurizing Putin is a priority for European leaders, but for now, they are weighing up how much pain they are prepared to inflict on their own people. Russia's economy is integrated into the global economy, and that means sanctions will hurt not only Russia, but the countries that impose such penalties. Sanctions are generally meant to bring about a policy shift or a change of leadership, but experience shows they fail to achieve those goals, despite bringing a lot of pain to the civilian populations. Whether Russia's efforts in the past years to make its economy sanctions-proof will pay off, or how the country will survive the tough sanctions regime it's facing, is anyone's guess. But the main question is, if the Western countries are prepared to go all the way and sanction Russian energy exports altogether.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is John Ross. He's a senior fellow at the Chung Yang Institute for Financial Studies, who joins us from London. Also joining us, Paolo Raffone, Secretary General at the SIPI Foundation, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. John Ross, I'm going to start with you. It must have looked very simple in some ways for the Russian President Vladimir Putin to have executed this military operation, given the military superiority of Russia and the Kremlin perhaps thinking that this operation is going to take a limited number of days, perhaps, or a short period of time. But at this point, we're looking at a gamble that Russia was hoping that if the duration was going to take a little bit long, that it could draw upon its war chest of about $630 billion. We can see that that has not transpired. Do you think that the Russian strategy in terms of its support is something that was either underestimated or not thoroughly thought through by the Russian president?
No, I think that the estimate of the situation in Russia is very simple. Russia was facing a deadly threat to itself. the incorporation of Ukraine into NATO would place NATO missiles, including nuclear missiles, about 5 minutes flying time from Moscow. And Russia made clear it was not prepared to accept this under any circumstances, in exactly the same way that the US in the Cuban Missile Crisis was prepared, if necessary, to go to nuclear war in order to prevent there being Soviet missiles within a few minutes flying time to Washington. That was the position of the United Russia in this situation, the same as the US, and it struck against that. Then people totally misunderstand the history of Russia. Russia has been attacked four times. This is the fourth attack on Russia in the last two centuries. Mm-hmm. From the West, but from Napoleon in 1812, the Whites in 1918, Hitler in 1941, and each time Russia has defended itself and defeated the people who attack it. If you think it's going to be put off by the fact that Russian banks are taken out of SWIFT, or the Russian people are not capable of suffering that, they completely misunderstand Russian history.
Okay, we need to, but the history is not, Paolo Ruffone, what is transpiring right now, today, looking at the different tools that Russia has in terms of trying to sustain sanctions. I talked about the war chest. I'd like to find out from you how Russia is estimating or forecasting at this point, from this point forward, how it's going to be able to maintain its military operation. Obviously, the sanction onslaught, which we're going to get into, is so severe. One of the consequences has been Russia's accessibility to its funds, which at this point, at least $460 billion worth, it can't access. No, this is for Paolo Ruffone. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paolo Ruffone.
Yeah, evidently these the sanctions are unprecedented, also because they are targeting the central bank, which is one of the key organs of the identity of the state. So they are really unprecedented. So far, these kind of actions called sanctions were targeting commercial interests or individuals specifically. This time, they have been a leap forward. I do not see much of a problem for Russia because finally the reserves that Russia has, also in terms of gold and other assets, are sufficient to sustain the needs of Russia, even in the military endeavor that is carrying out. Mm-hmm. So there will be some problems, as we already know, there are some problems in the adjustment from an open world to a closed world, but they will keep going.
All right. Well, let's keep going and look at the broader world and look at the impacts that this has had, John Ross. The price of oil, it hit $140 a barrel. I mean, these are prices we haven't seen since the year 2008. We're looking at countries that are suffering from it, really worldwide. But in particular, in this case in point, we could talk about the U.S., or you can talk about the U.S. and also Europe, in terms of how it's impacting those economies. And we talked a little bit about the Russian perspective, but is this something that you think the Europeans and the U.S., which in some ways are leading perhaps this whole sanctions, did think that through? Was it in their calculations that oil would get to this price? And then what about a strategy for substituting it, which, again, we'll talk a little later as to some of the different routes they have taken?
No, I think they probably didn't calculate it would go to this price. I mean, I think it's destroyed the Biden presidency. I mean, he's already got inflation problems in the United States, and with the price of oil, I think he's finished. And therefore, the aggressive policy which the United States has carried out against Russia, because that's what's involved, the situation was totally clear. Russia was perfectly prepared to accept for Ukraine to be neutral. It was not prepared to accept for Ukraine to be part of NATO. Biden insisted on going ahead with the policy of NATO. He's now produced a war. He's produced a gigantic oil price. And he will lose the presidency as a result of this. So he's done himself in. Similarly, prospects will unroll themselves in Europe. But in the United States, it's totally clear. But Biden has committed suicide by this aggression.
Some say, according to some polls, one poll, that Biden's presidency is going to be defined by this Ukraine war. Well, John Ross, Paolo Raffone, the U.S. Is suffering from economic fallout from this because we know that Russia is actually the third country on the list of the U.S. when it imports oil. Of course, we're looking at Europe also suffering from this. The price of oil has led, there was inflation, and now this is adding to the rise of inflation, which is at record levels, not only in the U.S., but also in Europe. So these shockwaves, is it sustainable for the U.S. and for Europe, let alone the rest of the world? For how long you think that this course can continue?
For Europe, it will be very... Hello?
Yes, you're still there.
For Europe, there will be a serious problem very soon because the shortages, not only in energy supply, will hamper the small economic restart after the pandemic. So the situation will be, from a socioeconomic point of view, extremely tense, if not dangerous. And we will see it in the coming 3 months or so, because data that are coming in that basically with the level of prices of today, most people will have just to either not heat themselves or stop their activities. So this is a situation that will backslash on Europe. And the awkward attempt to make the deal so that Iran could trade its oil because of the nuclear agreement is apparently in jeopardy at the moment, because the Americans have been pushing to a level that finally even the export of enriched uranium to Russia is not possible. So this is a sort of a cage-22 situation. Europe will have to rethink this aggressive sanctioning policy that has adopted.
Well, I'm not too sure if Europe is rethinking that, John Ross, when you're looking at, for example, how European gas prices are trading at MarketWatch said is equivalent of over $500 per barrel. You're in London. This is what's amazing, where bills are set, electric bills, energy bills, are set to hit £3,000 this year. That means 40 million UK citizens are heading for fuel poverty. So when our guest Paolo Raffone talks about Europe needs to think this through, well, people are going to, they don't have enough money to heat their homes. And we know in the UK, people die as a result of not being able to afford their electric bills or their gas or energy bills. Is this something the UK is taking into consideration?
No, but I think it will result in the fall of a large number of European governments, West European governments, because they've embarked upon a policy which is deeply damaging to their population. And in the contrast in Russia is that people will rally behind the government, because you don't understand Russian history. Russia, to defeat Hitler, suffered 27 million people dead. Undoubtedly, the Russian population will suffer as a result of the sanctions. But they're not, you know, it's nothing. I won't say it's trivial, but it's nothing compared to what Russia has been through in its history. Therefore, they will rally behind what the government is doing. Whereas in Western Europe, I would say, because of the result of the inflation, a large number of Western European governments will fall. And as I said, the Biden administration has committed suicide.
Okay. It's interesting. Paolo Raffone, what we're trying to do here is look at the Russian perspective and then look at the perspective from the Europeans and the U.S. And maybe we could put the rest of the world somewhat in that, minus, obviously, Russia's allies. It seems that the perspective from the European and the U.S. side is putting aside the interests of the people. And they're solely going after Putin. They want to bring Putin to its knees. The desire seems to be portrayed as such. Do you think that motivation
is costing the Europeans and even the U.S. the well-being of their own citizens as a result of their sanctions regime?
Definitely it is, and it should be understood. So we are trying to understand who does what and why. So from the U.S. perspective, the challenge through military means that Russia has made is intolerable for the fact that it is putting an end to the hegemony that the United States have had since the end of Second World War in Europe, in the way that we have seen unfolded, especially in the past two or three decades. So this is something that for the United States sent all the strategists ballistic. And so they have now put in place this incredibly nonsensical aggression to a single person, which is Putin, and trying to unite the ranks in the West against this enemy that has been identified. Well, this is working in the short time now, but we have to see already in the medium time what will happen. And I doubt that democratic governments, which are inelastic to restrictions and shortages, will support this kind of policy.
Okay. Let's move on to another aspect of this, if we can, John Ross, and talk about the dollar, in which the U.S. has been very fond of using it in many different ways, and one in its foreign policy by weaponizing the effect and the use of the dollar. It's one of the tools in the U.S.'s toolbox. It seems to think that it could do that when it comes to Russia, through the sanctions policy especially. But many analysts are concluding that this may backfire, that the dollar is going to get threatened. One way that it's going to get threatened, and I'd like to ask from you, is how Russia has de-dollarized its economy for quite some time. And you add to that, for example, a major ally like China, who's been doing the same, not to mention Iran, who is also on that path. Do you think the dollar will be threatened as a result of the Ukrainian conflict and how it's progressing in that direction more and more?
Well, the position of the dollar will be weakened, but the dollar remains one of the strongest aspects of the United States. I do not anticipate that the dollar will collapse as the main means of international payments in the coming period, and therefore this will create problems for Russia. Russia and China and Iran and other countries have definitely been attempting to de-dollarize, but this is a very difficult process which will take maybe 10 or 20 years. So my estimate would be that the sanctions, including the dollar, will impose pain on the Russian population. I don't want to pretend that they won't, but the Russian population, because they conceive that they're defending their country, will be prepared to withstand this pain much more than the governments in the United States or Western Europe are capable of withstanding that pain. So I would like to say that the dollar will disappear, you know, as an international currency, you know, in the next 5 years, but I don't honestly believe it.
Well, this one particular viewer seems to think otherwise, Paolo Raffone, and I'm going to read off what he has posted. The decision to push almost 3 billion people from Russia, India, and China into trading with each other in currencies other than the dollar will go down as one of the most short-sighted and self-destructive policies in U.S. history. Do you agree?
To a certain extent, yes. It is evident that the building of this wall of sanctions and threats of military interventions, let's also think to Taiwan, it's something that is strengthening the links between all the rest of the world out of the West. So this is also something that we have seen, despite the majority vote in the General Assembly of the United Nations, the declarations of the single governments before the vote they were quite interesting. I mean, they condemned the use of force, of course, because we are in the UN and it is the charter demanding it. But at the same time, there were a lot of nuances. So continuing this aggressive approach may risk to shift the majority of people who voted in the UN towards a new majority, which says we have enough of this aggressiveness of the United States, its dollar and its guns. So this may happen. And it is a gamble. We have to see what will be the evolution in the next days or weeks of the current warfare in Europe.
Okay. Well, since I'm looking at the clock, we really don't have that much time here. You've mentioned, John Ross, a number of times Russia's history here. And I'd like to also point out how the Russian President Vladimir Putin on many occasions has said that these nationalists or far-right Nazis, as he's called them, are using people as human shields. The history check that you gave us, the statements from Vladimir Putin, none of this is truly reflected in the media. Why is it that that side, the Russian side, is being neglected, at least to show, and I'm not promoting the civilian casualties caused as a result of this war, nor promoting war. Why isn't that side being, or that narrative at least, being covered in the way that it should?
Well, because the West has been carried on for 30 years a policy of aggression against Russia, that's the United States. The United States pretended that its only opposition to Russia was over communism, but once communism collapsed in 1991, the United States continued its aggression against Russia. So that shows that what the US policy was a total lie. So if you have 30 years of aggression against Russia, the truth of the situation is going to be concealed at the present time, and that's exactly what's happening.
30 seconds, Paolo Raffone. The threat of a third world war, nuclear proliferation, economic recessions possibly, in U.S. maybe, and Europe, and not to mention other parts of the world, the civilian casualties that have happened. Is that all worth it based on what has happened? Based on how...
This is really tragic what we are witnessing. I mean, it's something that wiser people like Kissinger or Kennan, who certainly knew the situation, they've been warning about in 2014 and after that. And the leaderships that have been coming to the United States, unfortunately, do not seem up to the task and have the knowledge enough to handle a situation which is dangerous if they push it too far.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. Paolo Raffone there, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation for Brussels. Thank you for your input. And thank you for your analysis, John Ross, Senior Fellow at the Chungang Institute for Financial Studies from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Newsroom at pressfv.ir. Any questions or comments, that's our email address. You can send it to us. From Mikome Tagwe, entire team, it's goodbye. Until the next Spotlight.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in the previous episode, you heard the account of Imam Khomeini's proposal for marriage to Khadija Saqafi, whose father was one of the renowned ulema in Tehran. If you remember, it was said that there was opposition towards this marriage, as the girl was from a rich family and might not tolerate tough conditions of a clergyman like young Sayyid Ruhullah, who had little material facilities and was seriously engaged in a struggle against the puppet tyrannical regime. Today you will hear more on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Lady Khadija Saqafi's father raised several conditions for her daughter's marriage with Imam Khomeini. Firstly, he had not married before. Secondly, he had no children. Thirdly, he should be rich enough to administer an ordinary family. Fourthly, he should not transfer his wife's house to Khomeini. Mr. Lavasani informed Sayyid Ruhullah of the conditions, and the latter accepted all of them. Thus, Khadija's father took a handwritten promise from Imam Khomeini not to change the daughter's residence. The young couple resided in a small house in Tehran. They stayed in this house for a few months as Sayyid Ruhullah decided to go to Qom to attend the courses in the seminary of that city. Lady Khadija Saqafi relates the story as follows. A few months had passed since our marriage. It was the Nowruz of 1309. The house rent had expired and a spring was near. The classes were going to begin in Qom. The groom, this diligent student, was very enthusiastic. He was just thinking of Qom. In other words, he was preparing me to leave for Qom. He was eager to go while I was not. He would insist and I would keep silent. I knew that there was no escape and we should go, but I could not give up soon. It was hard for him to stay, while for me it seemed impossible to leave, as I didn't like Qom for living with a person whom I had not got used to yet. I was very scared. Imam Khomeini's wife continues her account on leaving Tehran for Qom. I had accepted to live with Mr. Ruhullah. Now, against my will, I had to leave Tehran, my parents, sisters, and brothers, who all live there. I had to leave everyone for a place where I would be lonely. But accompanying the husband is a principle, and I had to live up to the determinations which God has set and I have accepted. I should accept them with satisfaction, as it determines my happiness in this world and the hereafter. The Quran says it may be that you dislike something while it is good for you, and it may be that you love something while it is bad for you. Therefore, young Khadija set out for Qom, although she knew that life in that city would surely include many problems. Lady Masume, peace upon her, was her only companion in that lonely city, as she says. Till the end of staying in Qom, whenever I was upset or sad, I would go to Lady Masume's shrine.
I would cry there and clean my eyes. Then I would return home with a happy heart and joyous face. After all, I had made the decision when I wanted to come to Qom, as I had no one other than Lady Masume to confine with. Imam Khomeini and his wife left Tehran for Qom on Farvardin 14th, 1309, corresponding with April 3rd, 1930. Lady Khadija Saghafi relates the account. Finally, we were to set out. The truck was hired, and it was the first time that I was traveling in such a vehicle. My dowry was loaded on the truck, and we were placed on narrow seats. Some others also got on the truck. I was crying right till Hassanabad. After nearly 3 hours of crying, Mr. Ruhullah said, "That's enough. Have patience." I was silent and choked my feeling, which caused me sore throat. The young couple rented a small house after 1 week of staying at a friend's home. Khadija soon made friend with the wife of the owner. She says, "In my first letter to my mother, I wrote that, in spite of being lonely, I have found a good friend, and Mr. Ruhullah has rented a nice house which has 14 fruits. Do not be sad for me. Imam Khomeini's first child, Mustafa, was born in this house, only to decrease his mother's loneliness." Imam Khomeini's third residence was located in an old neighborhood in Qom. The rental was hard for the couple to pay, as young Ruhullah wouldn't like to receive the stipend from the sources of emulation and had made himself content with the income that he would get sporadically from his paternal real estate in Khomein. Lady Khadija Saghafi relates the story. "The rental was a little high for my husband. We led a life of a seminary student in or a small house. Mr. Ruhullah had a small real estate in Khomein, which we tried to make ourselves content with, that not to show our need. He would never accept any stipend and was very magnanimous. However, the revenues of the real estate were not regular for us to rely on. We had to live in tough conditions for 6 months so that the wheat in Khomein was sold to get our share to pay the debts. Yet, Mr. Ruhullah preferred hunger for his child rather than accepting the stipend, although other ulama and students would receive it. He was very knowledgeable, and the sources of emulation were ready to pay him other amounts of money, but he would never accept. He let us taste hardships to taste freedom. I tolerated patiently so that he remains Haj Agha Ruhullah. At last, I brought those hardships to their knees." Dear listeners, the revenues of Imam Khomeini would receive little of his father's real estates and farms in Khomein. But this does not mean that he had a poor family. His father was a very generous man who used to spend great parts of his revenues to the poor and the needy. The family would feed hundreds of people during wars and famines. He had a lot of properties, farms and gardens in the villages around Khomein, but he used to spend the revenues mostly for charity and religious schools. Lady Khadija Saghafi recommends the young generation, try to live simply, try to be content, try not to be indebted to anyone for a better and wealthier life. If a person wants to live with dignity and pride, he or she should heed lest the luxuries of this world may not deceive him or her.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.